The words freedom and liberty appeared 42 times in President Bush's second inaugural address, and they're expected to be just as prominent when he delivers his State of the Union message at the Capitol here in Washington later tonight. President Bush is hardly the first president to invoke the words. Beginning with George Washington in 1790, every president has mentioned the word freedom in the State of the Union. Indeed, freedom and liberty ring throughout our history as goals, first principles, and ideals.
As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity.
And Korea is where we first stopped the spread of communism in Asia and fought to defend the international ideals of freedom.
We know the sun will always rise on America as long as each new generation lights the fire of freedom.
The world is becoming a better place because freedom is on the march.
Americans of all kinds embrace both the words and the ideas that underlie freedom and liberty, but those meanings are subject to interpretation. Definitions change over time. So how do you define freedom and liberty? What's the distinction between the two, and what do they share? First, we'll hear different perspectives on President Bush's use of the terms. A bit later, we'll talk with an historian who studied how the meanings of freedom and liberty have changed since colonial times. Later in the program, jazz singer Jimmy Scott joins us in Studio 3A to talk about his art and his long road to rediscovery. But first, freedom and liberty. Call or email us to say what they mean to you. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now from the studio at member station WBUR in Boston is Orlando Patterson, a professor of sociology at Harvard University. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Good to be here.
After the inaugural address, you wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times where you said, "The president speaks eloquently and no doubt sincerely of freedom, both abroad and at home, but it is plain for the world to see that there's a discrepancy between his words and his actions." What did you mean by that?
Well, what I mean, first of all, is that if you look at his policies over the past 4 years, his claims about freedom are simply not realized from one perspective of freedom, namely the liberal democratic one, which emphasizes security, which emphasizes participation, which emphasizes equality, and which emphasizes respect for civil liberties. This administration, in the opinion of most experts, have come closest to violating basic civil liberties in the way in which the Patriot Act has been applied, in the treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo Bay, in the skirting with or within virtually accepting the possibility of torture as a means of getting responses from prisoners, and in more importantly, the way in which our privacy has been invaded repeatedly, and there's been a turnaround in over the last 4 years in the relationship between the state and the citizen. Traditionally, from the liberal democratic point of view, the citizen's privacy is sacred virtually, and the state is kept at bay, whereas the state is supposed to be transparent. Now that's been turned around to what's called a new normal, in which the state has become extremely secretive, and however, the individual's privacy, his medical privacy, and other rights in that respect have been violated. So there's just a long string of ways in which freedom, as understood in the liberal democratic sense, has been violated by this government. Now, it's very surprising, nonetheless, that the president celebrates freedom. And my puzzle is, how does he get away with it? And my explanation simply is that he gets away with it because the tradition, the view of freedom which has emerged in America in recent decades is in fact departed from this liberal democratic view. And while the president may voice it on formal occasions, such as the inaugural or in his speeches addressed to the world, his followers are a substantial number of Americans, perhaps a majority, hold to a view of freedom which is very different from the liberal democratic one, which they may voice formally, but in practice, when you sit down with Americans and ask them, well, tell me what you mean by freedom, as I've done hundreds of hours of interviews. Tell me what you experience when you are experiencing freedom. What acts are you engaged in? The responses are surprising and very disturbing. Basically, Americans now take freedom to mean doing what you want, getting your way. It means having choices. It means being able to expand one's possession and one's power. It's a positive view of freedom. And it's just as interesting what's left out. I've spoken to Americans for hours and hours about freedom, and they never once mention anything having to do with democracy or with rights. Indeed, one development is that rights are viewed almost with suspicion. You shouldn't forget that a president in recent decades actually taunted his opponent, I'm thinking of Reagan, with the view that he's a card-carrying member of the American Civil Liberties Union. Now, one would have thought that in the land of the free and the home of the brave, that it should be a badge of honor and a source of pride to be a member of a Civil Liberties Union. But in fact, it was used as a very telling weapon against his opponent. And indeed, there's a great suspicion of rights as things which is associated with women being too uppity, with blacks' liberation, with the poor, with immigrants, and with criminals. So that's the state we're in now. Freedom, in a sense, to average Americans, excludes the liberal democratic notion. And the other thing which is, as I said, left out is participation in democracy. Well, this was perhaps the most significant finding, not only in my interviews, but in my national surveys.
Well, let's hear from some Americans about what freedom means to them. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And I don't mean to restrict it to Americans, to those of you listening. Anyway, let's talk to Carrie, who's calling from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi. Yes, I think that freedom has to do with equal access to opportunity through economic rights in our country. I think that the chasm that exists between those who have and those who don't have is just growing in America. And I think that the actions of this administration have contributed to that. And I think globally the same thing is true. I think the way that Americans conduct themselves affects everyone. And I think that freedom has to do with being able to sustain oneself. And we need to be mindful of that. So that's what I think freedom has to do with.
Carrie, thanks very much. Orlando Patterson, you wrote about something similar to what she said in terms of the domestic policy in your piece in the Times. But I did want to ask you also about how you think that word freedom is heard differently by people overseas rather than people at home.
Well, people overseas judge the president by his actions, both overseas and locally. What people overseas see from American foreign policy for the past 100 years is association with a string of tyrants and dictators, South Africa, the Argentina, Pinochet's Chile, Brazil under the military. I mean, the list goes on.
To be fair, some of them might see the liberation of Europe in the Second World War.
Yes, we were involved. We were involved with actions such as that. But I'm talking about the Third World, especially, and not Europe, really, although Europeans are also quite alarmed by developments in America now. The Third World, the majority of people whom the president has in mind when he's talking, people in the Middle East, people in Asia, and so on, there's the view that there's some hypocrisy here in the sense that American foreign policy has not only been too often associated with tyrants for one to take this seriously, including current sort of behavior, the relationship with Pakistan, for example, and the fact that for such a long time America tilted against the world's greatest democracy, which is the world's largest democracy, shall we say, which is India. There are many other cases I can cite in that regard, and it's people also look at American domestic policy and wonder what kind of freedom do we actually have in mind, given the fact that America has, and this is in reference to what I said earlier, America has a third world level of infant mortality, that a country, the richest country in the world, has millions of children without sort of health insurance and so on. And for the rest of the world, freedom means nothing unless it is associated in, to some degree with security.
We just have a couple of minutes left with you, but I did want to ask, we will be hearing tonight from the president as he delivers the State of the Union about democracy and freedom on the march. And I have to ask if the elections, well, last year in Afghanistan and this past Sunday in Iraq, change your opinions at all?
Not at all. I mean, the democracy, if it's to mean anything, must mean more than elections. I mean, we know that from scores of cases all over the third world, which achieved independence with grand sort of democratic structures, had elections, and within a few years, they're all gone because the will was not there and the sort of basic sort of institutional support was not there. Democracy, what has happened in the world now, by the way, is that authoritarian governments have learned the trick of how you can have what the conservative magazine, The Economist, rightly calls phony democracies, in which you have elections every 5 years, but really do not have a real participatory democracy. I think people are very skeptical about it. Now, let me say clearly that I'm one of those who strongly believe in the diffusion of freedom, that freedom, one of the best things that could happen to the world is that if every country were to become free. My basic problem is that I see us going about it the wrong way. You cannot force people to be free. You have to use persuasion. You have to use engage them in a discourse. You have to sort of use a carrot more than a stick in persuading people that this is the best form of government.
Orlando Patterson, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Orlando Patterson is professor of sociology at Harvard University. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue talking about notions of freedom and liberty with William Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard. And, of course, take more of your calls and emails, 800-989-8255, TOTN, at npr.org. This is NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about freedom and liberty. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. This from Mark Kernell in Portland, Oregon. Here's my take on the concept of freedom. My old Sunday school teacher used to always say, your freedom ends where the other guy's nose begins. And we thank him for that. Joining us now with a different interpretation of President Bush's use of the terms freedom and liberty is William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, and he's with us by phone from his office here in Washington. Bill Kristol, welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks. You wrote in a recent editorial, Bush's second inauguration moves American foreign policy beyond the war on terror to the larger struggle against tyranny. It grounds Bush's American foreign policy, in American history and American principles, those being liberty and freedom.
Sure. I mean, if we go back to Truman, if we go back to Woodrow Wilson, for that matter, in World War One, and if we go back to the founding, and Bush does actually in the speech, of course, implicitly cite the founding fathers. The only person quoted by name is Lincoln. He alludes to the Truman Doctrine. He alludes to Kennedy. He alludes to Reagan. I do think there's a tradition of America defending our own freedom, defending the freedom of others when under assault in Europe, obviously, in the 20th century, and now trying, and we can debate the prudence and the mechanics of how to do this, but trying to defend the friends of freedom and, in some cases, expand the boundaries of freedom and democracy around the world and especially in the Middle East.
Our earlier guest, Orlando Patterson, was talking about two different kind of connotations of the word freedom, one being talking about rights and our individual rights and our collective rights as well, but the other being also a more privatized idea of freedom, essentially do what you want, don't tread on me kind of. Do you think that President Bush thinks in either of those definitions?
Well, I think when we talk about America defending freedom, it includes both definitions. Iraq may choose to have a more less privatized economy and a more collective sense of freedom than we would have, and they might do some things that would, in fact, offend our sense of individual rights and individual freedom. Obviously, there are tensions within the notion of freedom. Every sensible person knows that. President Bush knows that. On the other hand, I think one can lose the forest for the trees here. It's an interesting debate in the U.S. whether we should have a collective social security insurance scheme or whether we should move more towards private accounts. It's an interesting debate. I don't think it, on the other hand, I think we can all, people on both sides of that debate can agree that being governed by a tyrant like Saddam Hussein is not free, and voting in an election for your own representatives and working with them to set up a decent, pluralistic, tolerant sort of democratic government, that is free. So I don't think, one can get a little too... I think it's sort of a fundamental character of freedom, of democracy, of self-government that underlies some of these important differences that we debate domestically.
Let's get another listener in on the conversation. This is Matthew, who joins us from Kansas City.
Hi. I wanted to comment on this based primarily from a philosophical or a specifically Platonic point of view in the affect and the creation of a concept of freedom in the ideal. That same singular ideal is never the same in two different instances. Your previous commenter, in his ending words, spoke about a dialogue. Well, if you're talking about a dialogue of freedom or the concept of freedom, no two dialogues are going to be exactly the same. Thus, no two concepts of freedom in society are going to be the same for each society. Each society is going to have its own concept of freedom. Added to that, right now America is in a state. So if we are in a state of war, the same concept or the same affecting of freedom in a state of peace is going to be entirely different than the one that we necessarily, because we are in a state of war, has to be brought into creation in a state of war. It's based on the context, on the environment that you're bringing to the table in that dialogue of freedom. I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, Matthew. Bill Kristol, you studied philosophy.
I did once quite a while ago. Look, one of the things one learns when one studies political philosophy, I think, is the gap between philosophy and politics. And I would sort of come back to a certain common sense here. Sweden and the U.S. have quite different understandings of freedom, different social organizations. These differences are not unimportant. On the other hand, what President Bush is talking about is liberating people from tyranny. I mean, it's not an accident that he said the core statement of the speech is that the policy of the United States is to seek to end tyranny as much as possible around the world. I think we can all agree that Saddam's tyranny, or obviously Nazi tyranny, or Stalinist tyranny, or North Korea's tyranny, is really ghastly. And then we can have an interesting debate once we set to help liberate people from these tyrannies, and once we help strengthen civil society and push and peaceful ways, let's say, to take a place like China, which obviously isn't as bad as North Korea, but to help push against authoritarianism and against limitations on freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion. We can then debate some of these other issues of exactly how we want to balance individualistic freedom versus a kind of common understanding of self-determination and the like. And I don't mean to minimize these other issues, but I think it's a way of I don't think this is that complicated what the president is talking about.
Well, don't you fear that people around the world might see a disconnect or even hypocrisy in enunciating these fine words? And then, as Orlando Patterson was talking about, one of our most important allies in the war on terrorism is Pakistan, a country that has a military dictator and where freedom is, it's not free.
Well, Pakistan's a lot freer than a lot of other countries. I mean, it has a military dictator who has usurped the electoral process for now. I personally would be interested in pushing harder for the restoration of the electoral process and of genuine parliamentary self-government. On the other hand, we can distinguish Pakistan from the way Afghanistan was or from Saddam's Iraq. And as Bush himself says in the inaugural speech, I mean, Bush gets criticized either way. If he's hard-headed and realistic and says, look, we can't do everything at once, there are, as he put it, governments that have habits of control whom we have to encourage and work with and help build the conditions so they can move towards greater freedom. If he takes that kind of moderate view, people say, hey, you're a hypocrite. If he says, we believe that all men should be free, And then people say, well, look, look at your policy. You're working with Pakistan. You're not toppling the governments of Saudi Arabia or China right away. So I think he's hit a reasonable middle ground of pushing towards greater freedom while acknowledging that the whole world's not going to be free tomorrow, and there are plenty of governments we have to work with in practical ways, whether it's Pakistan or China, for that matter, and working on North Korea. But I think Bush has been, you know, there are things I would change in his foreign policy, but I think on the whole he's been pretty good at balancing the constraints of necessity and the desire to push for greater freedom.
One final question before we let you go. Do you see a distinction between freedom and liberty?
No, I mean, not really. I think in practice Bush uses the terms pretty interchangeably in his speech. One is a Latinate word, you know, from libertas, and the other is, I guess, an Anglo-Saxon or a German word originally, freedom. And I think they're used pretty much interchangeably in general American public discourse.
William Kristol, as always, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Bill Kristol's editor of the Weekly Standard and joined us by phone from his office in Washington, D.C. David Hackett Fisher, is there a distinction between liberty and freedom?
There was at the beginning. The words have very different origins. Liberty, as Bill Kristol said, comes from a Latin root, and along with the Greek word eleutheria, it meant the condition of being separate, independent, autonomous, and unlike a slave in that way. Freedom's origin took me very much by surprise. It comes from an Indo-European word that means dear or beloved. And I scratched my head over that, and then suddenly it dawned on me that freedom or Freiheit meant the condition of being connected to other free people by ties of affection or kinship, and in that way, unlike a slave. So they mean the same in one way, that is, a condition that's the opposite of slavery. But they also mean different things in regard to connection and separation.
David Hackett Fisher is a history professor at Brandeis University, author of the book Liberty and Freedom, A Visual History of America's Founding Ideas, and he's with us on the phone from his home in Massachusetts. If you've been listening, you heard two very different interpretations of President Bush's uses of those words. I wonder, what's your reaction as a historian?
Well, I have a third take on Mr. Bush in particular and on the history of liberty and freedom in general. My understanding of it is that this has been going on for a very long time, 16 generations, and every American generation has had the same interest and, I would say, obsession with liberty and freedom. It began with John Winthrop and whose speeches were centered just as much as George Bush's on these ideas. At the same time, there's never been a single definition of liberty and freedom in America. They've always been contested. And in that contest, they've always grown. And so we have a single process, not a single definition, but a long history of liberty and freedom that I think has expanded. It's grown larger and more complex. And we can also see that happening in the history of Mr. Bush, whose thoughts have changed as well. If we go back to his time as governor of Texas and then following through the election of 2000 and then to his second inaugural, his notions of liberty and freedom have changed in interesting ways.
Hmm. How would you describe those changes?
Well, for Mr. Let me start with the nation and say that we English speakers are the only people in the world who have both liberty and freedom. There's been a tension that's been like a coiled spring in our culture. We have through the centuries tried to find resolutions of that, and that tension has inspired many different ideas. In the 18th century, we tended to call them liberty primarily, and that I think was particularly because we were struggling for independence from Britain. Today, it was interesting to hear the quotes from the other inaugural addresses, and I believe that all of your 20th century presidents were quoted speaking mainly of freedom.
Hmm.
The language has shifted. Many people, as Bill Kristol says, today use these two words as synonyms, more or less. And when they say liberty and freedom, they mean a lot of it, rather than something more specifically different. But these inherited meanings don't go away, and the problem doesn't derive. And so we have something that's almost like the DNA in American culture, that is the tension between the rights of belonging, which is what freedom is about, or was about originally, and the rights of independence, and we've worked out solutions to their reconciliation in many ways, and that's been a source of growth. Then, if I could go from that to Mr. Bush and your question about how has he changed, and when we look at his Texas speeches, they were much more about the old idea of liberty, that is to say, minimal government, individual autonomy, individual responsibility. And gradually he's been shifting, and the second inaugural began to broaden that idea. He actually introduced the language, quoting from Franklin Roosevelt, on a broader definition of liberty and freedom. Which included things like freedom from fear, freedom from want. And he quoted Franklin Roosevelt on that as well.
Yeah, and email on this, President Wilson outlined four freedoms, writes Alan Schickman of St. Louis, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear, he adds, sounds right to me.
Yes, and to many Americans. And it's interesting to see how Mr. Bush, I think, in his second term, after he's finished his electioneering, is now running for history, and I think he is thinking in much broader ways about what he is for. Whether he'll translate all of this into acts is another question, and I think Orlando Patterson had a point about that. That is, one of the sad ironies of American history is that people who are the defenders of liberty and freedom have often taken away the liberty and freedom of others. That started with the Puritans, and it still goes on. And in the 20th century, when we fought a series of the word that we're not supposed to use today, crusades, though Wilson used it frequently, crusades for liberty and freedom, they all began by diminishing liberty and freedom in this country. But they ended by expanding these ideas.
We're talking with David Hackett Fisher about liberty and freedom. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in on the conversation. Nikki's with us from Galesburg, Illinois.
Yes, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious. I love that you're having this conversation because I have heard Bush, our president, use the idea of a hatred of freedom frequently in speeches, that terrorists or extremist groups hate Americans because of their freedom. And I just have trouble wrapping my brain around that concept. I wonder if your guest would like to comment on that.
I've heard Mr. Bush say that as well. It's also interesting to hear what the terrorists say. And we've been hearing from al-Qaeda, who've recently found it necessary to declare that they also are in favor of freedom. They say they're against democracy and in favor of what they call the rule of God, a phrase very similar to what the Puritans used in New England. But it's interesting that they themselves think that they have to be on the right side of this great freedom question.
Thanks very much, Nikki, for the question.
Thank you.
Before we let you go, your book was a visual history of these ideas. You include an array of images. I mean, we're all familiar with the Statue of Liberty and the Liberty Bell. Some of the other favorites.
Yes, well, hundreds of these images. The idea of it is that Americans mostly know liberty and freedom not as abstractions, not as ideologies, but as folkways, as something we learn very early in life, and we literally envision them. We see them in our mind's eye. And what we see are symbols. In the American Revolution, they were the Liberty Tree, which was very popular in New England and captured a much more a collective idea. And then in the backcountry, it was that rattlesnake that we all know, and with the motto, "Don't tread on me," that singular idea of liberty. And it was the great Quaker bell that spread up and down the Delaware Valley, and with a quotation from the Bible, the book of Leviticus, that one should proclaim liberty throughout the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. This was an idea that came from the universal principles of Quakerism. Mr. Bush quoted that, but changed one word in his second inaugural. He changed it to proclaim liberty throughout all the world and broaden it to a global idea. Later, we get other symbols that begin to give liberty and freedom new meaning. And it happened in the early Republic. And as the founders began to struggle with the problem of how to put together a nation that combined so many different ways of thinking about liberty and freedom, they invented yet more ways of thinking. One thing that they did was to create an idea of liberty and freedom as a democratic idea, and they symbolized it in ordinary Americans, Yankee Doodle, Uncle Sam, Miss Liberty.
David Hackett Fisher, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
David Hackett Fisher, author of Liberty and Freedom, A Visual History of America's Founding Ideas, joined us by phone from Massachusetts. When we come back from a short break, we'll hear from a jazz singer of legendary proportions whom many of you may not know. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.